Now, Chaharda Thakur Gijai, from the Gohosi, Gishai Chaitanya Prabhu, Nisananda Siddha, the Gadada, Shuddhi Gaur, Bhakti, Rindhi Gijai, Shri Siddha, Radha Krishna, Gopa, Gavida, Shama, Hundarada, Padha Gidi, Gopra, Nijai, Shri Vrindavan, Dham, Kijai, Navadar, Dham, Kijai, Gangi, Jumana, Tulsi, Bhakti, Devi, Gijai, Nanda, Bodhi, Vaishnava, Rindhi Gijai, Samaveta, Bhakti, Rindhi Gijai, Gopra, Ganandi, All glories to some of the bodies, all glories to some of the bodies, all glories to some of the bodies, all glories to Sri Guru, Sri Guru, all glories to Shri Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namaste, Saraswati Devi, Gauravani, Prasadane, Nirvishesha, Sundarvati, Pashtrachare, Yishoyatarane, Sri Krishna, Chaitanya, Prabhu, Nityananda, Sri Vedaka, Gadada, Ashwasati, Gauravakta, Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 7, Verse 47. Karman arabhate dehi dehe atman uvartana karma bhistano de deham ubayam tvalyo eka hata Karmani, material fruit of activities. Arabhate begins dehi, living entity, dehena, with that body, atma anuvartana, which is received according to its desire and past activities. Karma B, such material activities. Tanute, he expands. Deham, another body. Ubayam, both of them, two, indeed, avivekata, due to ignorance. Translation, living entity which receives his present body because of his past fruit of activity may end results of his actions in this life, but this does not mean that he is liberated from bondage to material bodies. The living entity receives one type of body, and by performing actions with that body, he creates another. Thus, he transmigrates from one body to another through repeated birth and death because of his gross ignorance. Report. The living entity's evolution through different types of bodies is conducted automatically by the laws of nature in bodies other than those of human beings. In other words, by the laws of nature, the living entity evolves from the lower grade of life to the human form. Because of its developed consciousness, however, the human being must understand the constitutional position of the living entity and understand why he must accept the material body. This chance is given to him by nature, but if he nonetheless acts like an animal, what is the benefit of his human life? In this life, one must select the goal of life and act accordingly. Having received instructions from the spiritual master in the Shastra, one is sufficiently intelligent. In the human form of life, one should not remain foolish and ignorant, but must inquire about his constitutional position. This is called Atato Brahmajigyasa. The human psychology gives rise to many questions which various philosophers have considered and answered with various types of philosophy based upon mental concoction. This is not the way of liberation. The Vedic instruction says Tat Vigyan Artam Sadguru Evam Vigachet. To solve the problems of life, one must accept a spiritual master. Tasmad Guru Padeta Jigasa Sarvitamam. If one is actually serious in inquiring about the solution to material existence, one must question more pride. Guru. Padvati Pranipatana Parinipashnana Sevaya Upadakshanite Jnanam Jnaninas Tatpadashnam. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. One must approach a bona fide spiritual master by surrendering himself, pranipatena, and rendering service. An intelligent person must inquire from the spiritual master about the goal of life. A bona fide spiritual master can answer all such questions because he has seen the truth. Even in ordinary activities, we first consider gain and loss, and then we act. Similarly, an intelligent person must consider the entire process of material existence and then act intelligently, following the directions of a bona fide spiritual master. Translation: the living entity was received this present body because of his past fruit of activity and the results of his actions in this life. But this does not mean that he is liberated from bondage to material bodies. The living entity receives one body, one type of body, and by performing actions with that body, he creates another body. Thus, he transmigrates from one body to another through repeated birth and death because of his gross ignorance. So the previous verses discussed the position of the living entity of misery in the material world. This verse particularly discusses the soul's acceptance of body after body and how that works. In other words, the law of karma is described here. So the law of karma works according to the activities of the individual. He is responsible for his activities, therefore he's also responsible for the results. So therefore it says atma anuvartina. According to the self, one and that body that one has, one gets a particular type of body. So we cannot blame one's particular situation in this lifetime on somebody else. Of course, we can say, well, it's parents and they're genetically produced person, whatever. But then we have to think of the jiva, which jiva entered into that body, and why. Okay? So that is because of one's previous activities. So therefore, ultimately, the individual is responsible for particular body and the karmas that take place in that body after he gets the body, which means the results of previous actions. This is applicable to the human being. The animal is not responsible for his activities, and therefore he is not subject to the law of karma. Of course, if one is a human being and gathers karma, then he may feel the effects by getting an animal body or whatever. But when the dog eats garbage, he doesn't get karma for that. Or when the tiger kills a deer, he doesn't get karma for that and then have to suffer. That's nature. And why? Because the animals do not have enough intelligence to be responsible for their acts. They cannot tell the difference between papa and punya, sin and pious activity. They cannot listen to the injunctions of scripture. So they cannot decide what is the goal of life. So these are the responsibilities and also the capacities of the human being. And he has to take advantage of that. If he does not, then he's similar to an animal, and therefore in the future he will get animal body again. If he does not think as a human being, let him be an animal, then he doesn't have to think anymore. So being a human being has a sense of responsibility. It is of course a gift in one sense, but along with the gift of being a human being, being superior to the animals, is the responsibility of the human being. Which means you have to be very careful how you act in this lifetime. So in other words, the human being with his intelligence has the possibility of extricating himself from the laws of karma. Yeah? And if he's a little less intelligent, but still somewhat intelligent, he can actually utilize the law of karma for his own advantage to get some happiness in this world. That is karma yoga system. And he's more intelligent, then he can actually destroy all the karmas and get out of the material world completely. So rebirth in the material world is a problem because pushes us from one body to the next, to the next, to the next. Its positive aspect is we get another chance in a future body. We make mistakes in one lifetime, we get a chance in the next lifetime to correct the mistakes. So that's the good part. The bad part is body after body, if we can continually act in an unintelligent way, irresponsibly, then we can get lower and lower bodies until we lose all intelligence and become an animal or a plant. And then we continue to take body after body in that type of existence. So all of these things have their pluses and minuses. The whole point, of course, is for the jiva to develop an intelligence to the degree that he can take responsibility for his actions. This, of course, involves not just his jiva, but his mind and intellect, etc. But those are actually secondary. The primary development is the development of the jiva himself. It is the jiva who is the experiencer of pleasure and pain and all of the different karmas. So through these experiences, ultimately the jiva himself must start to understand the nature of his activities, etc. And this way, the jiva can choose proper actions in one lifetime, elevate himself gradually to sattva guna further. However, there is a problem because generally people are unaware of the jiva himself and they're only thinking in terms of their minds and their bodies, etc. So to help the process, karma yoga is there to gradually elevate your body so that when you get to sattva guna you can understand, ah, I'm not the body. Before that, let the gunas operate. Yeah. So therefore karma yoga is good for people who are not in sattva guna and cannot understand that they're not the body. And when we get to sattva guna, then we can go quite quickly to understand not the body and then take to the process of bhakti. So the law of karma is at work for all these living entities. And in one body, we can exhaust the karma for that body up until the point of death by experiencing pleasures and pains. But that does not mean all of our karmas are gone, because we have stockpiles from previous lifetimes that are all still waiting for us. Plus, we do activities in this lifetime, which give results in future lifetimes also. So we can never exhaust all of the karmas in one lifetime simply by experiencing them. Only a certain amount are there to get rid of, and still we have stockpiles left, and we're accruing more karma. So there's no way in which we can just end karma by living in the material world. It doesn't work. There must be processes for stopping the karma and accruing karma. So, though jnana and yoga attempt to do this, it's a very difficult process. And the easier process is the process of bhakti. Of course, the theory behind all of this is that let us destroy the cause of karma. Again, ignorance. If we destroy ignorance, then we destroy the root, everything else must go away. So this is basically what jnana, yoga does, destroy the ignorance with knowledge. Then we're free. And the process of yoga is to stop all the functions of the subtle body, the mind, intelligence, ego, etc. And then through this process, destruction of the subtle body takes place by stopping it, and then we attain liberation. Now, both these processes are a little difficult to do. It takes continual practice to fix oneself in that knowledge and stop the actions of the antakarana or the mind, etc. So the other process of destroying ignorance is through knowledge also, but that knowledge is a little different. It is not simply knowledge that I'm not the body. It is also knowledge that I am the servant of the Lord. And when we accept that fact, I am servant of the Lord, that I should serve the Lord with devotion, that cuts out the root of karma. Of course, cutting out the root of karma is not really the goal of bhakti, it is a secondary effect. The main principle of bhakti is to recognize the relationship with the Lord and then act in that relationship. Secondarily, the karmas, etc., are destroyed. So this is the preferable process because in this process we don't have to stop all activities, we don't have to stop the senses and the mind and the intellect, etc. Rather, we engage them favorably in the service of the Lord. And this helps destroy the karmas. So this is the process of destruction of the karmas which are mentioned here. Though the other two processes, yoga and jnana, also claim this, they're rather difficult. And the process of bhakti does this as a secondary effect. And in fact, as Haridas Thakur says, even Namabhas is such that immediately you get liberation. So what the jnani strives for with much endeavor is easily achieved from a person who accidentally chants the name of the Lord, but to speak of intentionally chanting the name of the Lord. So in this way, liberation is considered a secondary side effect, which is not too important for the devotee. Two, Prabhupada here mentions that in order to stop this process of birth and death according to the process of bhakti, and even if one is to do jnana or yoga, one needs a teacher. And therefore, in the process of bhakti, we also emphasize the fact, as Prabhupada quotes here in, from the Upanishads, Sadguru Nevapagachet, one should approach a guru in order to get knowledge of the Supreme Lord. So though, theoretically, one can, some degree philosophically, with one's intelligence, come to some conclusion about I'm not the body, etc. All the details are not very clear. So it is through scripture that we will get the answer of who I am, who is Supreme Lord, etc. Traditionally, you cannot go to scripture on your own. Particularly the Vedas are not available unless you go through a person. You have to approach the guru, and if you're qualified to study the Vedas, then he'll give you the knowledge. And if you're not, then you don't get the knowledge. So in this way, there is some qualification necessary, and the guru judges whether you are qualified or not. There's a story, I forgot the name of the person, anyway, he was a Vedic story, told in the Upanishads of one students. It was in the Gurukul. They learned everything from the master. Other students were there. They all learned Vedas, etc. And then finally, they graduated when they're 20 years old or whatever. And then they went off and they got married. One of the students did not go away, and he remained there. There were no more students there, only he was the one living there. So he lived there with the guru, served the guru, the guru's wife was there. And then the student says, I know there is higher knowledge. You must teach me the higher knowledge. There's something higher than all this ordinary knowledge. And the guru said, okay, I will teach you something. But he didn't do it. So the student was there, and he was serving and serving. Long, many years went by. And then the wife said, well, you should teach him because he's serving so sincerely. Teach him something. And the teacher said, okay, I will teach him someday. Then the guru was called away by the king to do some sacrifice in the kingdom somewhere. So he said, okay, I'm going away. I'll teach you afterwards. I have to leave now. So he instructed the student to do the daily sacrifice and offer oblations as normally they did every day. And then when I come back, I will teach you something. So the student, after the teacher departed, then the student was there offering oblations in the fire, and he was thinking, oh, it would be so nice if I could get this knowledge. And he was offering oblations with the fire, and suddenly some devatas appeared before him. And he said, who are you? I said, oh, we are devatas. We have knowledge. We will teach you this knowledge that you desire. Do you want the knowledge? And then he said, yes, give me that knowledge. So the devatas taught him the knowledge. And he was very happy to complete the sacrifice. And at that time, then the guru returned. Teacher returned. And he said, oh, something has happened to you. You look different. You're glowing. You're effulgent. What has happened? And then the student said, well, the David has taught me the knowledge. And then he said, now you teach me the knowledge. So the moral of that story is that this is recited in the Brahma Sutra commentary of Baladeva to show that the mercy is a necessary element. So he, even though he got the knowledge from the devatas, he then understood that I should properly get the knowledge from the guru. So therefore he requested the knowledge from the guru again, even though he had the knowledge, whatever. So the idea is there that mercy is stronger than efforts in one sense. So that's one example given. To point out the fact that no matter how knowledgeable we can get on our own, still we should go through the process that is outlined in the scriptures and go through a person and get the knowledge through a person, whoever that person may be. Now, we could say, well, the devatas are more qualified, so why did he have to go back to the guru? Anyway, he went through the guru because that is the traditional process. And he understood that mercy of guru is necessary. His teacher, he accepted his teacher, therefore he should go through his teacher. So in this way, he followed the traditional process of getting the mercy. So, of course, in the Bhagavatam, we have many examples of this, many quotations, and of course in the Upanishads and other places also emphasizing a guru. This, of course, does not necessarily mean the Diksha Guru. It could be a Shiksha Guru also, or whatever. It doesn't really specify. But nevertheless, knowledge has to come through some authority. And one has to receive that knowledge with humility. So therefore it says, pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. One has to approach properly. And we also see that even Krishna followed this process. Now Krishna, of course, is Supreme Lord, so he doesn't need a guru. He does not need anybody to teach him at all what to speak. A jiva. He doesn't need anybody to teach. Huh? Yet he also follows this process, of course, to set an example for others. So he goes off to the ashram, Sandipani Muni, gumball around and they learn everything. And they follow the process also. They're very humble, in spite of the fact that they know more than the guru, because it's Supreme Lord. But they're serving the guru nicely. And of course, you know the famous story of they went to the forest to get the wood and it rained out, etc., and all this in the forest. So they serve very humbly to show that in order to get knowledge, the proper process is humility, service, inquiry, etc., pariprashna, paripata, and seva. And in this way, they got their knowledge from the guru. Of course, they did it very quickly, 64 days or whatever, and then they went back home with perfect knowledge. So, therefore, even Krishna sets the example of accepting through another person, taking the knowledge. In the Vedic system, of course, it was absolutely necessary for two reasons. One is there were no books, so everything was oral transmission, and therefore you had to learn from somebody else. And secondly, the knowledge should not be given to an unqualified person. So therefore, it was only the teacher that could decide, I will teach this person, not that person. And nowadays, of course, everything's in books, so you can access the Vedas in books and everything. So a little bit different. But in those days, no. You don't get the knowledge unless you went to a guru and he judged that you were qualified. Then he gives you the knowledge. So very necessary to go through a person. Vedavyasa, of course, then compiled the Vedas and gave it to his disciples to carry on. That also was oral tradition. To be merciful to the people of Kali Yuga, of course, then we have Puranas and Mahabharata, Itihasa, which does not require the same qualification of being a dvija, Vaishya, Kshatriya, or Brahmana. So everybody can study. Still, even there we see that it went through a line. Vasudeva appointed a person to be in charge of the Puranas, Itihasas, etc., and passed them on also. So even they went through oral tradition, and there was some discrimination of the guru and who he would recite the Mahabharata or the Puranas to, even though they being a dvija was not a qualification. Still, something was necessary there. In the modern world, of course, things have changed, and therefore we have printed books, and now we have internet things, and whatever, so information is everywhere for everyone. Is it good or bad? It's good because it becomes more accessible. It is bad because everybody can misinterpret it according to what they want. And even the Puranas and the Mahabharata, you know, you can misinterpret that also in very various ways. So, in any case, still, we need someone to say, oh, this is what it means, this is what we do, this is what we don't do, in spite of the fact that Mahabharata may say you can do this and this and this. No. We need some authority there also to decide the limits of where we go within our particular teachings in Sampradaya. So there are always some teachers necessary there. So in this way, that teacher, of course, had a teacher, so that the same principles remain intact through the ages, even if they are not explicitly mentioned in the scriptures. Nevertheless, it is understood, and therefore the teachings remain with the proper meaning into the future. So, therefore, the teachings have to come in proper line of authority, and then we'll get the correct meaning and correct application.
You mentioned that the animals are born out of karma, but we are in the practice.
Well, they don't accrue karma by their actions. They may be suffering the results of karma because they were a human being before. So that part they get, but they don't get the results in terms of when they bite somebody, they don't get a reaction for that. That's
all.
Could be, yeah.
What's that? Yeah. You get attacked by a tiger, bit by a snake, could be your karma. Yeah. But again, another point is that it's not necessarily everybody doesn't get bit by a tiger, but you could also provoke the animal so that he will bite you. So that's not your that's not karma, that's your foolishness. If you simply walk out into the forest and you know there's a tiger there, that's not your karma to get bitten, it's your foolishness. If you know there's a tiger there and you go out in the forest anyway, and you know the tiger is dangerous, so, you know, you don't go there. Use your intelligence. Well, yeah, if one is an animal, then one cannot predict what one is, or one is not in control of one's future. Right? So there's this gradual elevation, gradually, till you get to the human form. Once you get the human form, then you're tested with your knowledge and how you use it. Unfortunately, if you're in Tamagun, you have very little possibility. And therefore, in the Vedic system, the Tamagun person was not allowed to choose too much. He was told what to do. Sudra. And that protected him. So if we have a system where the ignorant people don't have too many choices, good for them. At the same time, they're taken care of properly, they're not exploited, so it's good. If we don't have such a system, then they'll do all sorts of bad activities, then they demote themselves again, go backwards again. So Tamaguns are rather dangerous. When you get upwards, the intelligence is a little more sharp, and then you can function a little better. Tamagun is very dangerous. So to help the system, well, we do have scriptures to help the individuals, and then we have a system of government with Varnashram, etc., to help the jivas in the lower rung get upwards. Otherwise, if we don't, it's chaos, definitely. And we can just gravitate downwards gradually. Well, as human beings, we do certain activities. We do tamasic activities, we get tamasic body as a human being. We do rajasic activities, and we get a rajasic life next time, whatever, like this. And if it's very irregular, unless we follow Varnashram system, then it becomes quite systemized. So the sudras have certain duties, and by doing those duties nicely, gradually they elevate to Rajagun, then they can become a Vaishya or Kshatriya, then gradually they elevate and become Sattvic, they become Brahmanical. So everything is precisely regulated in such a way that over many births, the jiva can elevate himself to the gunas if we have a system like Varnashram. Well, of course, I don't know if that rule is exactly applicable literally to the Vedas. That's more of a Vaishnavic thing, I would believe. Now, of course, even in the Vedas, the guru, of course, can judge the disciple very easily. The disciple, on the other hand, at least he can understand the conduct of the person and whether he does have real knowledge. he may not know the details of the knowledge, but at least he knows if he knows something of the Vedas or doesn't know something of the Vedas, so it's by looking at other people study under him or whatever. So to some degree you can understand. He won't know all the details, but at least he can judge the quality of the person to some degree, whatever. Well, some jivas, there are varieties of jivas. Some jivas have tendency to serve the Lord, some jivas don't. Because jivas means there's infinite number of them. They're each a particle of consciousness. They each have their own identity. And they each are variety. So some are nityamuktas because they are related to the Lord. Others are nityabuddhas because they don't like the Lord. That's all. So they're in ignorance. Because there's variety of jivas. Some people are blessed with special talents from birth itself, and some are not. Is this karma? Yeah, that's due to if they don't do anything, they got a certain time. Yes, that is affects some previous lifetime. Many lifetimes they've been doing a certain activity, then this lifetime they have that talent already. It's the effect of their previous efforts. Apart from humans, there are so many types of species like animals. And so the first question is why these other species are created, because they cannot understand God. Do these spirits, they exist in the spiritual world also? So why some jivas are put into lower species from the beginning? Are all the species created at the same time? Including the humans. Well, why don't we have just human beings? Why do we have so many other species? If a jiva, a human being, becomes so sinful and ignorant that he doesn't deserve to be a human being, what does he become? So we have to have other species. Well, we have human, lower species of life also. Do these species exist in the spiritual world? Not in the same way, because if nobody has a material body, there's no karma in the spiritual world. But we do have cows and birds and peacocks and lotuses and so many things in the spiritual world. They're obviously not material, and you don't get them, those bodies, by material karmas. Do these species, why some jivas are put into lower species from the beginning? What is the beginning? How you can trace out? Are all the species created at the same time, including the human beings? Well, more or less, in Brahma's creation, if you look in the third canto, fourth canto, it discusses Brahma's mind, Brahma started creating different things, and all the different elements came out there in a short period of time, including the human beings, first the human beings, and then different species of animals, etc., and plants. What? Yeah. So what about it? What about the animals? Without punya. Well. That example is given to show that the power of bhakti is so great, and of course Lord Chaitanya, because he is Supreme Lord, that even the animal jivas got affected. Now, of course, they cannot really dance like a human being. They don't have the same intelligence, etc. But at least they become favorable. So we see that in the circus, the bear dances also. That, of course, is done by other means. But out of joy, animals will do certain things. So because of the bliss of the devotee, it is said all living entities become dear, or that the devotee becomes dear to all living entities. So what to speak of the Supreme Lord? If the Supreme Lord is there, all jivas will feel blissful when the Supreme Lord is there, in their own particular way, of course. Yeah, that is training, of course. They're just trained. Tiger also can jump through a hoop or whatever, do some tricks. I guess they're not popular anymore. Nobody did the sinful activities to get those bodies. So therefore they're not necessary anymore. So the animal becomes extinct. Previous universe, they're carrying over the karmas from previous universe, previous creations. No, but before there was a universe, many universes, they were all destroyed, but all the jivas have their karmas from that universe, and when they sit in Mahavishnu, they come out, they continue where their last karmas left off.